Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said, one of the hosts on the Literary Studies channel. Today I'm speaking with Mikhail Epstein. Mikhail Epstein is Samuel Catlett Dobbs Professor of Cultural Theory and Russian Literature at Emory University. His areas of specialization include postmodernism, cultural and literary theory, the history of Russian literature and intellectual history, contemporary philosophical and religious thought. Professor Epstein is also an expert on Russian philosophy of the 19th and 20th century. He also authored more than 30 books and more than 700 essays and articles, and his works have been translated into 23 languages. Today we're discussing Mikhail Epstein's new book, The Irony of the Ideal, Paradoxes of Russian Literature, which was published by Academic Studies Press in 2018. Hello, Mikhail.
Hello, Natalia.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, before we discuss your book, would you tell us a little bit about your background, about yourself, because you have such an impressive background and such an impressive career path?
Well, I studied Moscow State University. I graduated from philological faculty and specialized in Russian literature and in theory of literature. So this was my major area of studies in the 1970s. Then I migrated to contemporary Russian literature and aesthetics, and with the 1980s and much more dynamic, aspiring spirit of this decade of perestroika and change and innovation, I was interested in the projective and constructive aspects of theory, how theory can influence the literary process, the artistic process. And so I worked in the genre of program and manifesto, and some of my ideas and concepts, such as materialism, conceptualism, presentalism, metabol, and others, were interacting with the creative aspirations of the new trends in Russian literature. And my first book actually was published only in 1988, when I was already 38, because under the censorship conditions in the Soviet Union, it was hard to publish anything which didn't fit into the very narrow limits of Soviet ideology. Though I was accepted to the Union of Writers in Moscow in 1979, but this didn't warrant publication of books. Then, in the year 1990, I moved to the United States and started first as a fellow of the Kennan Institute, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. And then I became professor of Emory University in Atlanta. And for this period of almost 30 years, the trajectory of my interest also changed rather dramatically. In the 1990s, I was interested in the problems of postmodernism, both in the West and in Russia, in comparative perspectives. So I published several books on this issue, and also I moved from theory of literature, from aesthetics, to more fundamental areas of philosophy, theory of modalities, ontology, epistemology, and also wrote a book on the philosophy of the possible, published in 2001. So postmodernism and philosophy were the hallmark of my 1990s. Then, with the next decades, my main interest focused on the humanities as the entire field, which combines various disciplinary approaches. Of course, There is literary studies, such areas as literary studies, cultural studies, linguistics, philosophy. And I tried to elaborate on the general self-consciousness of the humanities in the century of, technological and scientific revolution, where the humanities seem to be lagging behind the progress of technology. And this became one of my major preoccupations in the 21st century. So I published several books in Russian and in English. English book was titled The Transformative Humanities, A Manifesto. It was published in 2012 by Bloomsbury Academic, where I tried to offer a program of practical, constructive engagement of the humanities with contemporary culture, and how the humanities can revive their crucial meaning and significance for cultural development, which the humanities enjoyed in the 18th century, in the 19th century, and then lost it to hard sciences and hard technologies. So I'm interested in the humanistic technologies. Nevertheless, during the same period, I continued to write about Russian literature and language. One important part of my work was what I call projective approach to language evolution. Beginning 2000, I published several pieces in Russian and in English on the possible lexical and grammatical transformation of language, and one of these books was published in English, the pre-dictionary, meaning both proto-dictionary and pre-dictionary. That means a collection of words and grammatical constructions that I find necessary for the dynamic evolution of English language and Russian. So these are my main areas: philosophy, cultural studies, literary studies, and linguistics, and all of them in projective dimension. How they can influence society, social imagination, cultural imagination. But I continue to work also on more traditional literary studies, and my book, The Irony of the Ideal, Paradoxes of Russian Literature, which was published several months ago, is, so to say, my debt to the oldest area of my study, with which I began my engagement with philology at Moscow State University. So this is the book on Russian classical literature of the 19th and 20th century, from, conventionally speaking, from Pushkin to conceptualists, to Prigov, Sorokin, an attempt to find a new way to look at Russian literature, not purely historical, not purely theoretical, but combining historical and theoretical perspectives.
Well, I feel like I would like to ask you more questions about your career path, because it's so impressive and it's so rich. But going back to that phrase that you mentioned about literary studies and about this recent book, which is written in a more traditional way. However, the book itself doesn't look like traditional, and those approaches that you exercise are quite innovative and they far from being rather traditional. So before we go into some details about this recent publication, would you just give us your vision of how literary studies changed over this time period that you actually devoted yourself to this field? Because you mentioned that it's more traditional if compared to other interests that you invest yourself into at this point. But still, what? How would you summarize this development of literary studies over the over these decades that you work within this field?
How the literary studies in general evolved during this period? Well, it's difficult to build a linear progression because. And this is what I think about cultural evolution in general. It is not one evolution. It is a series of evolutions, diverging evolutions. So some literary, some part or aspect of literary studies developed, and this is important, of course, direction to merge with cultural studies. With intellectual history, history of everyday life, so to be built into larger cultural field, which is interesting, important. Another less, I would say, dynamic field of literary studies inherited semiotic structuralist, post-structuralist perspective on literature. Of course, Lotman was enormous influence on this semiotic structuralist approach to literature, and then French post-structuralism, deconstruction. So this is another very important and influential trend in literary studies. I would say that my approach doesn't coincide with any of these. I'm interested in metaphysics of Russian literature. However, traditional, this term can appear, because metaphysics is often associated with something pre-Kantian, with a paradigm of thinking which should be, first of all, criticized. But at the same time, Derrida himself and post-structuralism, while trying to purify the humanities and, first of all, textual studies from metaphysics, at the same time acknowledged the impossibility of such ultimate purification, because metaphysics is not something that is imposed on literature or any aspect of human activity. It is what makes human human. It's the relationship between any human activity with the system of concept, with noosphere, with conceptual sphere, semiosphere, which is full of these universals, of these general concepts. And the point and the task of a literary scholar is to inscribe literature into this conceptual sphere without sacrifices on behalf of literature, without sacrificing the richness of its imagery, its metaphors. So my enterprise is to investigate the metaphysics of Russian literature not in the same terms in which we can examine metaphysics of philosophy. That means not as a so to say, explicitly and intently metaphysical utterances of Russian writers, not metaphysics that is imposed on literature by philosophy, but inherently metaphysical, unconsciously metaphysical aspects of Russian literature, in the same sense in which, for example, Joseph Brodsky used to say that literature that is devoid of metaphysical taste cannot be called literature. It is belles-lettres. It is entertainment. It is something addressed to lower levels of cultural perception. Metaphysics is a must of grand literature, of big literature. So it was a difficult task to build metaphysics of Russian literature. At the same time, not to rely on big meta-narratives, metaphysical narratives. So I take into account the critique of meta-narratives that was undertaken by postmodernist, post-structuralist readings of literature. I do take into account, but I want to build metaphysics without metaphysics of literature without meta-narratives. This is the task. Even more so, as Russian literature was a victim of meta-narrative interpretations for many decades of Soviet regime and still continues. It is the greatest temptation of literary scholar who wants to think about literature in grand metaphysical terms to submit it to some meta-narrative, be it Marxist meta-narrative, which is familiar to all of us who studied in Soviet school, or as the history of liberational movement going through from nobility to raznochinstvo, then to proletariat, and so on and so on. We know this. Then there is, so to say, Christian or Orthodox meta-narrative that presumes that Russian literature from its very beginning ancient Rus literature, the Moscow period, Petersburg, despite all temptations, it still continued to be deeply Christian, and Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Chekhov, and then Pasternak, Solzhenitsyn, this is the mainstream of Russian literature. It's gospel revelation. This is another way to translate, again, literature into some not political revolutionary meta-narrative, but interreligious Christian meta-narrative. There are other ones, for example, Russian Cosmism, which reads literature from the point of view of Nikolai Fyodorov and Daniil Andreev, which reads into it the resurrectional impulses. And this is also quite, so to say, established pattern of interpretation, or Eurasianism and Slavophilism. So there are, which becomes especially topical now, Russian literature as the history of struggle against the West, of defense of spiritual and aesthetical sovereignty of Russian literature. So my approach is different. It's metaphysics without meta-narrative. It's an attempt to to get rid of this linear approach. I believe in clusters. I believe in nodes. I believe that you cannot build a true understanding of literary whole just in time. You have to look at the space of literature, a continuum of literature, where Pushkin, Tolstoy, Platonov, Pasternak, Nabokov, they talk to each other in one time, what Bakhtin called big time or great time of literature. So within each of these pieces of this puzzle, I looked at different aspects of Russian literature and find the such as, for example, relationship between metaphysical problems, between word and silence, or between reason and madness. I try to designate the major problem in terms of paradox, because Russian literature, I believe, is moved by paradoxes. The very foundation of the new Russian literature, and which go back to Peter the Great's reforms, was paradoxical, because it was an attempt to build new Russian culture on the foundation of different culture, Western culture. And these two spiritual cultural matrices, they interacted in Russian literature in such a controversial, contradictory, paradoxical way that we find these contradictions in every subject, in every thematic or problematic area of Russian literature. For example, the ideas of greatness and humility. Russian literature demonstrates how the highest standards or visions of greatness reveal their demonic nature, using, of course, the influences of Goethe, Faust, especially the second part of Faust, and the interaction of Pushkin's vision of Peter the Great, Peter the Great's deeds, and Faust's enterprise on the seashore, how these motifs encounter each other in a certain problematic knot of Russian literature, first of all presented in the Bronze Horse. Yes? And this is the first part of the book, The Titanic and the Demonic, Faust's Heirs. It is the title of the part, and it looks at the Bronze Horseman, the problem of demonic irony, when Faust and Mephistopheles, which are separated in Goethe's great tragedy, are actually brought together, merged in the image of Peter the Great and Pushkin, who is both Faust and Mephistopheles at the same time. From Mickiewicz's point of view, Peter the Great is Mephistopheles. He is the devil. From Pushkin's point of view, he is both Faust and Mephistopheles. This is the first paradox of Russian literature in terms of book's composition. And then we look further and find that we can, even looking at Pushkin himself, within his world, to find such paradox as comparing the Bronze Horseman and his fairy tale on the golden fish, we find the same subject, the same narrative actually, in its high tragic and, so to say, low comic aspects, because the old woman and the golden fish in Pushkin's fairy tale, of course, they imitate the relationship between the autocrat and the elemental, the revolting element, the sea, rebelling against the will of the Peter the Great, or the old woman who is a parody of Peter the Great. So we find this paradox not only in the relation of Pushkin and Goethe's great masterpieces, but we can read Pushkin through the prism of Pushkin and find paradoxes within Pushkin himself. And then the same interesting self-contradictory aspect of the theme of the Titanic and the demonic we find in Gogol, the most lyrical and inspirational pages of the Dead Souls. Who is the only positive hero of the Dead Souls? It is considered to be Russia of the lyrical digressions. If we come to more close reading of Gogol, we find that this is the most terrifying image of the Dead Souls, because all texture of these lyrical digressions come to Gogol. Gogol's Dead Souls from his earlier works, where the same imagery is applied to the witch, to the demon in the Terrible Vengeance, and other demonic imagery of the early Gogol. So we see again how Gogol, contrary to his own metaphysical and patriotic intentions, betrays the demonic nature of Russia as mother witch, in the most anthem-like fragments of his poem. This is only one part, the first part of the book. But the same strategy is undertaken in any other part. You find the most metaphysical aspects of Russian literature, where its conscious intentions come into contradictions with its deep unconscious, and this is, of course, my own debt to deconstruction, because deconstruction is a very deeply ironic procedure, because we see how the writer wants to say something, and it turns out that what actually his or her writing says is opposite to what to the initial intention. So I tried to demonstrate the same deconstructionist irony in reading Russian literature and its major narratives without building them into narrative linear sequence of meta-narrative. The second, for example, part is another aspect of Russian major obsession with the value of humility, yes? Starting with the theme of the little man in Russian literature, yes, Акакий Акакьевич Пашмачкин. I like to, to rely on the most familiar school, so to say, foundations of our knowledge of Russian literature, and then to demonstrate that within this most elementary, most self-evident, obvious aspects of Russian literature, there are some very explosive, ironical irony of the ideal. This is the title of the book, ironical subtext. Okay, Акакий Пашмачкин. The most miserable of Russian literary heroes. But we see how from this seed a different plant is growing. And this is the most ideal character of Russian literature. The Prince Christ, as Dostoevsky calls him, Prince Mishkin. And I'm analyzing in detail the scene where Mishkin demonstrates his skills of calligraphy. And I find that it is actually imitation of Акакий Акакьевич imagery of a most humble scribe who cannot, so to say, introduce anything original in his writing. But while in Акакий Акакьевич this pure humility is reduced to absurdity, in Присмышкин it is again raised on the level of medieval spirituality of humble reproduction of Holy Scripture, of some abbot's signature, Abbot Пафнутий, is the whose sample of writing Mishkin demonstrates to General Epanchin. So this hidden medieval semantics of a scribe, of the image of a scribe as the most humiliated image of Russian literature is resurrected in its spiritual grandness in Dostoevsky. But then we see the other move from the same image. There is another successor of Акакий Пашмачкин in Russian literature in the opposite direction. It is Беликов in Chekhov's Man in a Case, who also is as legal offspring of Акакий Пашмачкин as Мышкин is. And again, we find so many both conscious and unconscious similarities between Belikov and Bashmachkin, their attitude to women, their attitude to writing, to their sociophobia, and the image of Andrei Platonov's characters, Simon Serbinov, who is actually possible, whose prototype is possibly Iosif Stalin, a little man who became the major dictator of the 20th century. This is also an offspring of Bashmachkin. It's not by chance Stalin liked to cite Chekhov and Gogol. It was his the unconscious beat, so to say, his club. So we see how Russian literature in its most ontological pieces is subversive in relation to its own, so to say, official school readings. It should be read in the opposite direction.
You mentioned these diverse matrix constructions that contribute to the development of these paradoxes of Russian literature. How would you define the relationships between these matrix constructions? Well, you introduced this term in this work, artistic philosophical bilingualism, when you write about Pushkin and Goethe. I'm wondering if this combination of different constructions is based on dialogue only basis, or there is some synthesis, there is some symbiosis, or there are some other flavors to this combination of different layers and overlappings.
You mean the relationship between Pushkin and Goethe, or Pasternak and Mandelstam and Russian language? What kind of...
Well, between these matrix constructions that you identified that contributed to the development of paradoxes.
They mentioned the relationship between Russian literature and German philosophy and German literature. It is one aspect of this paradoxical self-awareness of Russian literature, because, of course, it acquired its self-awareness from other cultures. And there is nothing unusual in it. We need to look at ourselves through the eyes of somebody else in order to see ourselves. And the same concerns the Jewish aspects of Russian literature as represented in the work of Pasternak, Mandelstam. Again, I'm not interested at all in their conscious identification or non-identification as Jewish writers, as representatives of Jewish spirituality. But when I read, for example, early verses of Pasternak, I lose my sense of his linguistic identity, mm-hmm. because they're written not quite in Russian language, mm-hmm. you know. And again, somebody will say, well, this confirms that Pasternak was not a truly Russian poet. But in this sense, I would say that all poetry in any language is not truly national poetry, because it speaks a different language than national language. And Aristotle, in his Poetics, emphasized that the use of foreign words, of exotic expressions and exotic constructions is necessary for poetry. And Shklovsky's theory of estrangement or defamiliarization is also part of this process of, defamiliarization as aesthetic device, as technique, which allows us to break the inertia of living and recognition, and to start aesthetical process of long and difficult perception of things. The theory of estrangement or defamiliarization or deautonomization is very important for me because I believe that actually the task of literary studies, of literary science, is to defamiliarize literature. It's not only, as Shklovsky believed, it is not only the task of literature or art to defamiliarize life. It is the next task, next level tasks of literary studies to defamiliarize the object of literary studies, literature itself. And this is what I undertake in relation to Tolstoy, which is the grand master of defamiliarization and the main bulk of Shklovsky's article on artist technique on defamiliarization comes from Tolstoy's body of text. So it is convenient, very convenient to use Tolstoy as an example how defamiliarization not only works in his works, but could work as a device that the interpreter of Tolstoy applies to the author himself, to Tolstoy. So I'm talking about this foreign, so to say, aspects of influence on Russian literature, Goethe, Jewishness, not because I focus on them. They're not important as such for me. It is just the same manifestations of paradoxes which defamiliarize our view of Russian literature and help to see it as something wondrous. I am Aristotle in my view of the task of the humanities. I join Aristotle, who said famously that it is wonder from which true philosophy is born, because it is wonder or surprise that makes us to see something unfamiliar in those things that we believed to be already known, and to enterprise a new investigation of this. So philosopher is a person who is especially inclined for the feeling of wonder. So this is a book of wonders in a certain sense, my reading of Russian literature. When I look at it through the eyes of German philosophy or Jewish spirituality, of these two kinds that I demonstrate in Mandelstam, Talmudic spirituality and Pasternak, Hasidic spirituality. So within one Jewish spirituality, there are two major traditions, which in my view explain much in the relationship between these two great poets of the middle of the early and middle 20th century. Within one circle, they're diametrically opposed to each other, Pasternak and Mandelstam. For Pasternak, it is the miracle, which is the defining feature of his view of universe, whereas for Mandelstam, it is the law, Talmudic law. Again, this is the stuff that requires paradoxical interpretation.
Early in the conversation, you mentioned the phrase, which I find interesting and intriguing, postmodern reading of texts. Would you elaborate on that postmodern reading in the contemporary terms? How do we read text today? How can we read texts today?
Well, it's a major issue, postmodernism. I started to write about Russian postmodernism when it was not any accepted phrase or term in the year 1990. I wrote before that on Russian conceptualism, on Russian meta-realism, but then I perceived it as, again, two paradoxical manifestations of Russian postmodernism. At the same time, I clearly see the limits of postmodernism, and 6 years later, in 1996, I published an article with the end of postmodernism in the title in the journal Znamya. So I contrary to some people who read my stuff in the 80s, in the early 90s, and who believe that I'm typical postmodernist, I am not. I clearly see the boundaries of postmodernism, and my identification is as belonging to the next formation, which comes after postmodernism, and which I call proto, which or protoism, which is oriented towards the future and sees our time as the beginning of some new cultural and technological trends rather than coming after. I think that postmodernism, the very term, is very reactionary because it defines itself through the relationship to the past, whereas proto, in the beginning, the first, defines itself in terms of the future. So, at the same time, I disagree with those people who condemn postmodernism, though I understand that much of what is going on in contemporary politics in the United States and Russia is, so to say, a vulgar version of postmodernism. I mean, post-truth and denial of facts, alternative facts, and complete lies and simulacra. I agree that postmodernism, as any grand movement, romanticism, realism, symbolism, becomes inevitably vulgarized at a certain stages of its existence. So, for me, the lessons of postmodernism, nevertheless, are very important. That's why I don't read Russian literature as a meta-narrative, as a linear sequence of some progressive development of whatever. I'm reading clusters. I'm reading it more in space than in time. This is also postmodern view. For me, Russian literature is rather a vocabulary rather than a book, you know. Mm-hmm. And I view all, I mean, rather than a narrative, vocabulary, you know. In vocabulary, all words, all concepts, they belong to one space rather than succeed each other in time. This is what I understand by postmodern or post-structuralist trace in my readings of Russian literature. But I'm far from, from a purely critical tenet of post-structuralism that denies authenticity, any authenticity, denies origins, denies authorship. I radically disagree with this. I believe that this paradoxical method that I apply, this, so to say, interplay between the conscious and the unconscious meanings of the text, is something that should be read constructively rather than pure ironically, which this enhances our understanding of Russian literature. It is rather than critique of traditional concepts, I try to regenerate them on a different level, on the level of construction rather than deconstruction. Mm-hmm. I call my approach positive deconstruction, so to say.
So in the final chapter of your book, you include a periodic table of Russian literature, cycles and phases of development, but you don't include this stage of Russian postmodernism there. The most recent section is the new sociality, metapolitics, play with signs of various political systems, political, literary, theatrical hybrids. And moral, religious, and aesthetic aspects here are left blank. So in this question, I have two questions. Where do we locate Russian postmodernism, given that you mentioned that you believe in some limits of postmodernism? So where do we locate postmodernism? And what are those blank sections?
I don't want to be too hasty, so to say. This table, periodic table of Russian literature, is built on big chronological dimensions. The first cycle is from 1730s to 1840s. It's a century, more than a century. And I find the succession of four phases within the cycle. Social phase, this is classicism, moral, sentimentalism, religious, romanticism, and aesthetic, which is Pushkin, poetry above morality, the poetics of harmonical precision, we are born for inspiration. So this is the first cycle. Then I find the same cycle with the same sequence of phases in the next period, from 1940s to from 1840s to 1920s. First, it's socially oriented literature, critical realism, natural school. Then the new sentimentalism, psychologism, Tolstoy, early Tolstoy, Dostoevsky. Then symbolism, religious phase, artist theurgy, myth creation, and then again, aesthetic phase, atmism, futurism, imaginism, the self-spun word, new language, artist device. This is the second cycle, which also continues for a century. Then the third cycle, again, social phase. This is socialist realism, prolet cult. Then socialist sentimentalism, Yevtushenko, all these generations of the 50s, 60s, confessional prose, the bad eye, sincerity, then the next stage, neo-romanticism, village prose, quiet poetry, mythologism, fantastic realism in our literature of the 1960s, 1970s, and then again aesthetic phase, conceptualism, when art, so to say, serves to reflect art. Self-reproduction of literary consciences in terms of concepts. And then the fourth cycle begins in the 1990s. And here I stop, because I don't want to project something which is not yet, so to say, accomplished. Here I try to be more, how to say, sober and realistic literary scholar than in some of other my enterprises. I fixed in the 1990s the new sociality, metapolitics, but I don't want to proceed to the next stages before they became clear in literary process itself, you know? It's enough for me, my theoretical consciousness is more or less satisfied by the fact that this cycle, social phase, moral, sentimental phase, religious or romantic, mythological phase, and then aesthetic, self-conscious, self-reflective phase, these four phases are alternating in three major cycles of literary development from the 18th to the end of the 20th century. And I don't want to make any forecasts for the next cycle, which can take also a century or big time dimension. So
And postmodernism, Russian postmodernism, because when I first saw that table, my guess was that the most recent cycle will be postmodernism. And then I didn't discover this movement in the concluding section. So
I think that postmodernism, and according to this scheme as well, it is rather the consummation, the end of the previous stage. For example, in the cycle 4, which ends, which continues from 1920s to the 1990s, the last stages are characterized as conceptualism, play with empty language, signifies over and above the signified, and then rear guard, zero degree writing, decentering, entropy. This is postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
And like postmodernism, it is after something, you know. So I don't think that postmodernism is the beginning of a new cycle. It is rather the end of the previous cycle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
When literature starts to reflect itself.
I see. I see. So returning back to your mentioning of the metaphysics of Russian literature, would you agree that this approach to literature or this understanding of literature will somehow reshape or reestablish the relationships between society and literature?
Reestablish the relationship between society and literature. Actually, I don't think that this relationship was ever broken, you know. I would say that literature centrism is one of the major characteristics of Russian society. It is literature-oriented. It lives according to the laws of literature. Rather, literature lives by the laws of society. So they are mutually influential. I think contemporary literature, though I don't follow it as closely as I did in the 1980s, is also in a very tense relationship with society and reflects its emptiness, its fears, its lack of imagination, unfortunately, its orientation to the past. I don't see here any big problem with establishing a connection between literature and society.
So maybe what I meant there was a reconfiguration of the relationships. Maybe reconfiguration will be a more accurate word, not reestablishing some broken links, for example.
You see, today the very boundaries of literature become so fuzzy. Because everybody becomes a writer. There are less readers in contemporary society than there are writers. Everybody writes in social networks, in Facebook. And I think this is a very positive aspect of contemporary literature, that it becomes literature without frontiers. We are entering quite a new formation. It is sometimes called artificial intelligence, with all positive and negative implications of this concept. I don't know, is it artificial? Because any intelligence is artificial, actually. Culture is artificial. Literature is artificial, but there is some quality in contemporary writing which actually appeals to me. It becomes more, how to say, more, there is no reading without writing today. There is no such a strict division between active and passive aspects of literature. When you read something, you have to create the object of your reading, the text, looking in Google for various texts, and you don't read it incessantly in linear succession. You just take a fragment of one text and mentally overlaid with fragments from another text. So you are creating always your own anthology of text and fragments of text, virtual books, so to say. And you not only read them, but you constantly write into them by responding to somebody's posts with your own comments, by your own posts and so on. So it is, I call it megatext. I just published another book, which is titled «Проективный словарь гуманитарных наук», «The Projected Dictionary of Humanistic Disciplines», where I suggest more than 400 concepts to describe contemporary culture, philosophy, literature. And one of these concepts is textonics, which is a discipline of organization of texts in virtual spaces. And actually what we are doing, we're now creating this megatext, what Goethe in his days called world literature. Now it's not just French, German, Russian, English literature. It is one space where the science of various cultures and various languages, they interact in such a way that there is no, it is the book of literature, the entire text which we can contemplate on the web is the literature, you know? Mm-hmm. It is the world of letters, the world of characters with Google translation, which becomes incredibly accurate and even expressive in its way. There is no problem to read any text in any language you want. It's a very different reality. And when, for example, I'm writing less and less separate texts. What I'm writing is some interventions into this megatext, mm-hmm. the megatext of existing variety of languages, genres, and so on. And I don't feel lost, because actually whatever lives now in the network, in the internet, abides and will continue to abide, so to say, eternally. Who knows how long, but eternally, provisionally. And anything can be resurrected. As Bakhtin used to say, every meaning, every text will have its own feast of resurrection. Now we have technological conditions for this feast, for this resurrection. I'm looking for a certain phrase, for a certain image, for a certain association, and I immediately enter into brotherhood with all authors who ever suggested or used the same phrase. It is conversation across languages, across epochs, across genres, across disciplines, a very different consciousness. And I wanted in this book as well, though, as I said, it is one of the most traditional of my books, to engage Russian literature into this conversation, you know, conversation across languages, across the disciplinary boundaries between philosophy and literature, and metaphysics is a good way to transgress these boundaries, because metaphysics is not only one part of philosophy, but every field of human activity has its own metaphysics. There is metaphysics of football, metaphysics of theater, of music, of literature. So metaphysics is those most universal aspects of any human activity where it becomes clear for the human mind, the operational, algorithmical aspects of this activity. And thus I try to read Russian literature into this new metatextual whole, if such an expression, read into, is possible, to read it into.
Yeah, well, what you just described about writing and reading, I would say is very inspiring because it also contributes to shaping and creating new reader, where this new reader engages with texts more, and I would say engages with texts in a more free way. There is much more freedom in terms of interpreting texts, in terms of incorporating those texts into the individual's paradigm, so into individual's understanding of the self and of the of others. And creating and producing new texts through writing. Thank you so much for this incredible conversation, and thank you so much for your incredible research and sharing your very impressive career path with us. Well, to conclude our conversation, I would like to ask you, what's your current project?
Well, currently I'm working on several projects as usual. I'm bored when I work only on something. So my major project is Russian philosophy of the second half of the 20th century, which is almost unexplored, even in Russia, and completely unknown in the West, except for Mikhail Bakhtin, Yuri Lotman, and several separate names. So I'm writing a more or less systematic story of Russian thinking. I call it philosophy rather than philosophy, because philosophy and philosophy have somewhat different areas. After the death of Stalin and to the end of the Soviet Union. So I have a contract for this book. I hope to finish it this year. And also I have some other projects in under consideration. I'm working on the translation of my book, The Philosophy of the Possible, which I mentioned, into English, which also is under contract. And I'm working on the book called, in Russian, «Первопонятия», «First Concepts», the primordial concepts, such as, I don't know, life, love, sin, repentance, conscience, and so on. So I want to write a book on these intuitive concepts and to make it as articulate, explicit as I can.
Well, thank you.
Through which we live, but we don't understand them fully because they are purely intuitive.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mikhail. Again, thank you so much for joining us today. And on a personal note, I just want to add that I first read your works in Russian, and those works were on postmodernism, and they considerably helped me create my own understanding of postmodernism. So thank you so much for your incredible work and for your incredible research, and good luck on your future projects. And hopefully we will have another conversation very soon.
Thank you very much, Natalia, and I'm very grateful to you for your interest in my book, in my writing, and I'm really inspired by our conversation, and I hope to continue it in the observable future. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mikhail.